Oh, okay. Thanks.
And I believe we have Commissioner Bourne on the phone. Is that correct?
Yes, indeed.
Hello, Commissioner Bourne. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
So we talked to you a little the other week, I think. I'm losing track of days. And thank you for coming in personally this time. And frankly, the research folks, I think, are going to have most of the questions for you to explain stuff about the ISDA and derivatives contracts and things like that. So since we talked before, Greg, why don't you follow up with areas that you wanted to talk about?
Sure. I wouldn't mind just punting over to Randall. Randall's actually been working on our derivatives project, and essentially we've been looking at different ways that derivatives may have contributed to the financial crisis,
right,
either in the buildup of risk in the mortgage market in the prior to the crisis, and in the spreading of contagion that actually kind of made up the financial crisis the way we understand it. So I guess with that as an intro, where do you want to start?
Well, I thought before we got into what I would suggest is before we get into discussion is what role they play, not necessarily as a cause, but as part of the crisis, to also maybe just talk about a little bit about ISDA and the organization. We've been talking to some SROs. ISDA is not an SRO.
No, we're not an SRO in that sense. We don't make rules that people are required to follow. We don't enforce rules. We do set standards. We do develop standard documentation that are used extensively around the world for derivatives transactions. Again, these are privately negotiated derivatives transactions, the bilateral transactions that parties enter into. So that's the focus of the organization. There are other things we do, not just documentation. We're working on operational issues. We've developed collateral documentation and have worked on a lot of practices and recommendations regarding the use of collateral, which is extensively used in the OTC derivatives business. We've worked on tax issues, accounting issues, and we've also worked on legislative and regulatory matters, not just here in the United States, but around the world. And we are, just from the factual standpoint, we are an international organization. We have 7 offices around the world. We have over 800 members in, I think, 56 or 57 countries around the world, headquartered in 56 or 57 countries, and obviously active in many more. So from our very start, we've had a very international representation among our membership.
Yeah, so I take from that size of membership, you're no longer just dealers, but the end users have come back in. One time there was sort of a split, I think, and there was the End Users Association. Have they kind of come back into the organization now, and there's not a, you're no longer...
Yeah, we started
yourself as a dealer organization.
Well, that's right. We did start out, as you recall, as the International Swap Dealers Association. We, even in the late 80s, began to include non-dealer entities in the organization, at least to provide information to them, so they could become members even starting in the late 80s. We changed our name, I believe, in 1993 to the International Swaps and Derivatives Association. And now we have 3 basic categories of membership. One is the primary category, which actually these days is the smallest of the 3 categories. That is the dealer category. We have a category called associate members, which involve providers of services to the industry, so accounting firms, law firms, technology firms, those types of entities.
So third party.
Exchanges are members of the association as well. Clearinghouses are members of the association. And then we have another category which we call subscribers, which are kind of the everything but associates and primaries. And that includes corporations. It includes governments, kind of the borrowing arm of a government. So Kingdom of Sweden, I think, is a member, and various other central banks are members because they're using derivatives to help manage their currency exposure. So it's a diverse membership. We have, like I mentioned, about 800 members. The largest category is that third category. Smallest is the primary category.
And what was the issue with the end users? Procter & Gamble and some of those guys, that all came back in now, or what was that? I don't recall what that was about.
Well, briefly on my background, my history. I started out as a lawyer in 1984 with Cravath, Swaine & Moore in New York, and I was there until early 1991. And it was over that time that I got involved in working on kind of early form derivatives contracts, even before the ISDA master agreement. Mm-hmm. I also represented ISDA at the time when I was with Cravath, working with some partners who represented ISDA. I then left private practice. I went to Amrata Hess Corporation, which now called Hess Corporation, an oil company, working as an in-house lawyer, and really didn't do derivatives. If their treasury operation had a derivative to do, I was the one they turned to, but they were not, at least at that time, extensive users of derivatives.
They do a lot of weather stuff now, I think.
Well, I was there from 91 until late 1997. Sometime in 1997, they set up a trading company, which was half owned by Amrat Hess Corporation and half owned by a group of executives who came in to run that operation. I left in 97 to come over as the general counsel of ISDA. It was general counsel of ISDA from 97 until early 2001, held the CEO title until last November. I'm now executive vice chairman, working with our new CEO, a guy named Connie Bolstad. So that's my own history, and the reason I mention that is I was really not involved in those issues or whatever occurred in, say, the 1994 period that I think were the focus of the Procter & Gamble type things.
Era, I guess.
I'm not quite sure what you mean by the Brickell era.
Wasn't he the CEO then, or the... He was the
chairman of the board at that time.
Oh, okay.
He was the chairman of the board. I don't know the exact dates. He was chairman of the board for like 3 years or so.
Okay. Well, thanks just for some organizational history, because I think as you said, it serves many of the functions an SRO would do. Standardization. You even collect data. Right?
Yes, we collect data. We do three principal surveys: market survey, which is volumes of notional amounts outstanding, which we should spend some time, I think, talking about what that means. Then we also do we've done for a number of years what we call a margin survey or a collateral survey, assessing the rate of usage of collateral in the OTC derivatives business and the rate of usage of ISDA documentation for that. And then we also do an operations benchmarking survey, which looks at various internal operations issues in our member firms and allows, as any benchmarking survey does, allows firms to measure themselves against what the best practices or what the current standards
are. Is it an ongoing survey? I thought the last one I saw on your website was from 97.
No, the operations benchmarking survey has been done annually since 2001, I think, the collateral one. And we could, if you can't... Sometimes people say there's so much information on our website, it's hard to find and drill down to some of the stuff. So we'll, if you need some direction, we can happily provide you that.
Thanks. I think I was looking through it in preparation to speaking to you. I thought it was a great survey because it also focused on concentrations. That's one of the operational issues, if I recall.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't see there seemed to be some discontinuity recently. I didn't know if it was I had the impression it was a triennial. But we can... You can help me.
Okay.
I can find the series of it.
Yeah.
I think also before, well, maybe now it's just with a little background on your organization, and I guess you guys don't have any aspirations or plans to try to seek any SRO status in the light of reg reforms that are coming down the line.
That is not something we currently intend. Obviously, the legislation is not final yet. We'd have to take a look at that, but that's not the current expectation.
Okay. Well, I might be jumping ahead, but I mean, so how, just, and this, we're not supposed to look at reg reform per se, but just to understand better how the market works versus how it's envisioned under reg reform. I mean, how would that change the role of the ISDA master agreement if the clearinghouse or the central counterparty proposals were to go through?
Yeah, so it's a lot of different ways, and it depends on the nature of the clearinghouse and the way they run their operation.
Mm-hmm.
I guess maybe briefly on how things have existed. Mm-hmm. The ISDA master agreement is used, as I mentioned, extensively around the world. We haven't ever done a comprehensive survey. We kind of figure that 90% of derivatives trades are probably covered by the ISDA master agreement. There are country-specific master agreements that are used in France, Germany, China, Brazil, Mexico, other locations around the world. Mm-hmm. But in terms of anybody who is dealing cross-border or has aspirations to deal cross-border, they would typically do their transactions under an instant master agreement. Mm-hmm. Master agreement is a document that establishes kind of the relationship between the two parties, mm-hmm. Dealing with, you know, basic terms that are common to all transactions that would be governed by that master agreement, and mm-hmm. dealing with some of the essential credit terms, particularly events of default. So you'll see standard representations and warranties, standard covenants. You'll see a list of events of default, a process for closing out positions if there is an event of default, termination events, which are more kind of no-fault events that could lead to termination of some or all of the contracts, mm-hmm. governing law provisions, standard definitions. So it's kind of an overarching document. One of the key principles of the document is that the parties expect to be entering into one or more, in many cases, many transactions under that master agreement, mm-hmm. And that would be... it's the party's intent that all of their transactions would be governed by that master agreement, and that all those transactions together constitute that single agreement between the parties embodied in that master agreement. So, if you will, all those different transactions are just tacked on to the back of those, not physically, mm-hmm. but that's the legal effect of them. Mm-hmm. And that allows parties, under certain key provisions of the document, to look at their exposures on a net basis across many different types of transactions. So that's why, particularly after the Basel Committee recognized the process we refer to as closeout netting, which is the process in a closeout, which might be an event of default or a termination event, where parties are terminating transactions under the master agreement and closing out those positions, mm-hmm. they would do so on a net basis. The Basel Committee of Banking Supervisors in 1993, I think with effect from 1994, said that that was an enforceable version of netting for purposes of capital calculation. So from that point forward, parties were incentivized, I think, to put as much as they could under an ISDA master agreement. So that's why the document covers not just interest rates and currencies, which were kind of the original coverage, but also equities, commodities, energy, credit derivatives, weather derivatives, property derivatives, longevity derivatives, mm-hmm. many different types of transactions that could be brought under that one single master agreement. It allows two parties to manage that risk in a comprehensive way mm-hmm. across all those exposures. So that's kind of the way things work currently. Mm-hmm. And it's, I think, under the provisions of the law, I think usually the term is customized. Sometimes you hear bespoke, mm-hmm. bespoke transaction or customized transactions. Those transactions would continue to be done under an ISDA master agreement, we would anticipate. Mm-hmm. And so that's the expectation there. Now, as you move to more standardized transactions that might be required to be cleared under the legislation, mm-hmm. And standardization is not as simple as just standardizing the contractual terms. There's questions of pricing and liquidity, and many of that, much of that, will need to be kind of hammered out in the rulemaking process. Mm-hmm. Those standardized products under the legislation would be cleared. And some of the clearinghouses that exist currently mm-hmm. basically convert those transactions. Most of them assume that you would continue to enter into the transaction on the existing basis, perhaps via some kind of electronic facility, mm-hmm. maybe on exchange, mm-hmm. but you'd still largely do it the same way, but then you'd put it into the clearinghouse. And the clearinghouse, certain clearinghouses basically convert that contract to a futures contract, because that's kind of their traditional structure. The CME is a perfect example of that. Others, such as the ICE platform or the LCH platform, the ICE is used for credit default swaps here in the United States and in mm-hmm. Europe. LCH is used for interest rate swaps and has been used for a decade. Mm-hmm. LCH and ICE basically say they'll take the trade that you do between, let's say it's two dealers, mm-hmm. dealer A, dealer B. They will novate that. They will basically assign that trade. We call it novation. You basically give it up to the clearinghouse. Mm-hmm. They would have a trade between them, and it would be converted into two trades. You know, the one would be the buyer to the clearinghouse's seller. The other would be the seller to the clearinghouse's buyer, or mm-hmm. fixed rate payer or floating rate payer, depending on the transaction. And mm-hmm. in under the ICE structure and the LCA structure, those would be governed by ISDA master agreements.
Mm-hmm.
So the ICE, those clearinghouses currently have in place master agreements, ISDA master agreements, with their dealer counterparties,
mm-hmm.
And so you know the ISDA contract would still be used there. It's just that one of the counterparties would, by definition, be the clearinghouse. So that's how things are at least currently envisioned. Keep in mind that a lot of what the a number of the things that the legislation is focusing on, mm-hmm. clearing, repositories, elements of transparency, a lot of that has been part of an ongoing commitment process that the dealer firms, in particular, and other buy-side firms, large buy-side firms, have committed to as part of an ongoing process dating back to September of 2005 to deal with operational issues, to deal with this question of novations that I mentioned,
mm-hmm.
And ultimately committing to put more trades into a cleared environment, mm-hmm. or into these repositories. It's important to keep in mind, though, even you know, in the area that has the biggest outstanding in terms of notional amount,
mm-hmm.
which are the interest rate swaps, there's been a clearinghouse up and running for 10 years and was utilized in connection with the closeout of the Lehman bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm.
What percentage of the interest rate swaps go through a clearinghouse?
I'd have to get back to you on that. The commitments that have been made currently are at the 90 or 95% level for new transactions. One of the big challenges right now, and LCH is in the process of doing this, is backloading more transactions. And that's also true of the credit default swap space, trying to backload existing transactions. The commitments have been focused on new trades. And also, you know, they also focus on backloading trades. But I'd have to get some...
Yeah, but just for the new ones, 90% of the new ones are going through the clearinghouse for interest rate swaps.
90% of eligible trades between dealers.
Uh-huh.
Now, for LCH, eligible trades are a big portion of the... Because it's all the major currencies. It's pretty standard stuff, but there are also other transactions. They're mostly interest rate swaps that go through. You have swaptions, you have other types of caps and floors, other types of transactions, all of which are, you know, broadly speaking, OTC derivatives governed by ISDA master agreements, where you know additional LCH needs to be in a position to take those trades on. But in terms of the interest rate swaps, it's a significant percentage.
The legislation also talks about an exchange. Are there any exchanges right now, and how would an exchange work with the master agreements?
Well, there's not an exchange that trades a swap. I mean, go back 10, 12 years, the CME had a I forget what they called it, but it was an exchange traded swap transaction. It didn't track liquidity, and I don't think it trades anymore because it was too much like what people could do in the OTC business. Now, I think it's important to understand that as you look at a company, let's say a company company that has borrowed on a floating basis and wants to do an interest rate swap to effectively change that into a fixed exposure, right? So you've got a borrowing. They've gotten money in. They're obligated to pay on a floating basis. They're concerned about their exposure to the fluctuation of interest rates, so they go to a bank and they say, "Can you do a swap where the bank pays them floating and that company pays the bank fixed?" So you've got, in effect, the company sees floating out, floating in, fixed out, and if you net out those cash flows, they've converted that into a fixed exposure, and that is kind of the most fundamental interest rate swap that exists. There are once the dealer, it's a dealer that does that trade. All right, now they've got floating rate risk. What do? There are a number of things they can do. They could go out and find somebody else, whether it's another bank or dealer or another company that has the exact same the offsetting cash flows, and they could completely offload that risk.
Mm-hmm.
Not very likely that some other company is going to want to take that on exactly to match their cash flows. So they'll do a couple of things. They may actually, and they do fairly extensively, utilize exchange-traded products to hedge a portion of that risk. Now, the exchange-traded products are more standardized. They may not be able to match up exactly the exposures, but they can often hedge 85-90% of the risk that they have as a result of that trade. They may also just do a trade with another dealer for all or a portion of that risk. They may just decide to hold on to a piece of that. They may do a combination of all those things. And that's really what happens when dealers engage in this market-making activity. They're providing the product to the client, and then they've got to think about how they're going to manage exposure in an effective way using all the tools available to them. The reason I mention that is that there are exchange-traded products, particularly in the interest rate space, the currency space, that give you, and particularly the dealers, give you a fair amount of ability to hedge an exposure that you have as a result of your OTC derivative activity, the dealer's OTC derivative activity. And they utilize that extensively. If you talk to the exchanges, they'll tell you that their biggest customers are the OTC derivative dealers because they are the ones that have the risks that need to be managed. So that's kind of how it works.
I'm just having trouble envisioning how an exchange works here. So someone goes to a place and there are a whole series of market makers and you bid for the whatever it is, whether you want a fixed or a floating or whether you want some other kind of coverage.
As it relates to that more tailored transaction, bespoke transaction, it's really hard to envision how that actually gets done on an exchange. Because the beauty of an exchange, and there are many beauties of an exchange, is you've got a standardized product, you've got market makers committed to make a market in that standardized product, so you can always access that at any time, and the liquidity is generated by the fact that there is that standardized product with the market makers, so you can go in. But it's a standardized product. It may not match up with the, you know, if I'm the company borrowing money, I may be borrowing on payment dates that are, you know, the end of January, the end of April, July, and October. The typical interest rate contract on the exchange would have, I don't know what the roll dates are. I think they're, you know, the third Friday in March, June, et cetera. You know, the witching hours. So that's the standardized contract. So I can't, as a company, I can't use an exchange-traded product. And similarly, the dealer who takes on that risk as a result of that trade I described at the beginning will find itself not able to hedge that exposure perfectly with the exchange-traded product. But as I said, they could, you know, the fact that they're in a position where they're willing to take on that stub risk, if you will, between January 30th, 31st, and, you know, the third Friday of March, they can hold on to that and manage that effectively. They're two different contracts, and so I think that there isn't. It's hard to envision how these kind of tailored products would go on exchange, which is why the legislation does acknowledge that there would continue to be the need to, you know, to have customized contracts, bespoke contracts that would be done under. Well, they don't say done under as a master agreement, but effectively they would be, while still looking at ways in which exchange traded contracts could be developed.
Mr. Pickle, if you were going to trade through ICAP or one of the other interdealer brokers, and you would look at one of the electronic screens, they're listing fairly standardized interest rate and other products now, and that's what people are posting quotes on. So there is, even in that context, some willingness to operate in a fairly standardized environment. And if that's not now considered an exchange, but it's not very different. It's just not an automated order matching. You have to go through the broker to actually execute the trade. Mm-hmm. But aside from that last step in the process, it wouldn't look all that different from Globex or trading on NASDAQ.
And I think that the history of the derivatives business, OTC derivatives, privately negotiated derivatives in particular, has been one of innovation and standardization. We exist as an organization because we provided standardization as it related to the legal documentation, which is a big step, a necessary but not sufficient step to achieve the kind of standardization you're referring to on those screens. And I think is important as we look at the financial crisis and we look at the future is that we maintain the ability to innovate while also recognizing the benefits of standardization. And I always talk about the fact that, you know, we have this pipeline, and coming in at the top of the pipeline are innovative new contracts. I mentioned, you know, longevity derivatives, property derivatives, all these things that allow companies to manage risk that they may not have been able to manage before in a very effective way. Over time, partly due to our efforts, partly just through the evolution of the market, you do see greater standardization. And at some point, there is a point where either via things that are tantamount to an exchange, like you allude to, or actual exchange trading, those, you know, that should become a more attractive alternative, because the efficiencies and price discovery of exchange trading for those contracts become more apparent as you can achieve greater levels of standardization.
And what you guys did for the standard coupons on the credit default indices and single names was a huge move towards standardization.
That's right. And I think, you know, the expectation is, again, depends on what the final version of the legislation says, the expectation is that there would, you know, that would translate into a, you know, certainly a need to clear those trades particularly as between dealers. And perhaps even, you know, depending on the final law, need to develop an exchange-traded alternative for those trades. I would emphasize that, in fact, there are already significant commitments to clear those trades, and there's already been, via the clearing of trades and also the what's called compression in the current term, where trades have been basically eliminated because they were basically offsetting in risk. We've seen a significant reduction in notionals in credit default swaps from mid-2008 until the most recent numbers from us, which were basically down 50% from that mid-2008 stage.
So just to make sure I understood, you said LCH currently has 90-95% of eligible trades between dealers. Is it not an end-user market, or does it?
That is not an end-user market, nor is the platform. Well, I think ICE has opened up two end users, but they've not extended. But we ought to check on that one to get you the details on exactly how the end users are accessing ICE.
Okay. I think they envision, you know, having a clearing member relationship like the CME does eventually.
Right. Yeah. Basically the buy side access to clearing houses will be via a dealer, in the way that Randall mentions with respect to CME. The clearinghouse would continue to deal with the dealers, because they're the ones that are putting up the capital. They're the ones that need to, you know, put up additional capital if there's a shortfall or things like that. Mm-hmm. But then the dealers would need to manage that trade with their customer in the existing way. But the customer would get some benefit of the clearing process.
Yeah. The dealer in that context, as a clearing member, would act more as an agent.
Yeah.
And the any collateral posted would go straight into the clearinghouse and segregated accounts.
Yeah.
And no longer be held in the general account to be rehypothecated by the dealer. So it'd be they'd be involved, but in a fundamentally different way.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's a fair description. Yeah.
Okay. So how big is the end user market versus the dealer market? Is that something we know?
I guess we have some information on that through the BIS data on a global basis. I'm not
sure. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's probably the best public source.
And I don't think the OCC aggregates that. I think we could go back to the FY call reports and try to, you know.
That would be what the counterparties are. When you say public source, it makes me wonder if you were thinking of some other.
Well, we have very informally gotten some information. And this goes back a year from dealer firms, our board member firms. Basically, there are three chunks of the market. This is focused on credit default swaps, not the broader market. You've got the dealer market, which is a substantial piece. Mm-hmm. You've got the dealer financial institution market, meaning hedge funds, asset managers, and those types of entities. Then there's the end user market, which would typically be dealers. I mean, end users don't deal with hedge funds to manage their risk. They deal with banks and dealers, and so that's really a dealer end user market. And I think I can get that information for you, but I don't want to quote the numbers offhand. But we can certainly get that information for you. I think we provided that to the Treasury Department as well a year ago. Yeah. And I might just comment there that the reality is these markets, although I can tell you that the smallest chunk of the overall CDS business is the dealer and user business. The reality is this business would not exist but for that volume of business. Because it is those end users who have the real risk who basically set the ball in motion. They turn to their banks. The banks provide a product. They you know, they enter into these transactions where they the bank provides, you know, pays fixed, sorry, pays floating, the company pays fixed, or the bank, you know, does the, you know, takes the yen side of the trade and the company takes the dollar side of the trade. Once that happens, and I think the credit default swaps are a perfect example of that, where, you know, the a bank that has credit exposure buys protection from another bank to hedge that credit exposure. Once that's happened in all those transactions, now that dealer has a risk that it didn't have before. And it's got to go out and to make a decision. Do I hold on to that risk? Do I go on exchange for a portion of that risk? Do I talk to another dealer? Do I, you know, what do I do exactly to manage that risk? And so then they've got a decision to make to go out and hedge that in some way. And in turn, whoever they may deal with, particularly if it's another dealer, has a need to, you know, manage that risk. And so, you know, there's a lot of trading that happens in the dealer community by virtue of that ball getting rolling with the companies who really need to do that. If you didn't have companies who needed a hedge, it's certainly my view that you wouldn't have the market that you have. You may not have any market. You certainly wouldn't have the size of market that you have today. So it's all motivated by the need to provide that ultimate service to the end user, to the person who has the risk.
Okay. I'm going to go back to something you said, which was interesting. You said the ISDA standard agreement kind of got entrenched in the capital standards by the Basel Committee in '94, which is interesting. And I'm just wondering, are there other ways that the master agreement has been kind of accepted by regulators as an important thing, whether for capital or something else?
That's probably, keep in mind, the Basel rules didn't say the ISDA master agreement is what you need
right,
to do.
Right, but it said that
a process for, it set out three requirements. It said that you had to have, in order to calculate your bank regulatory capital on a net basis as it relates to your derivatives positions, you needed to have an enforceable master agreement, which the ISDA contract was. We had opinions on that. You needed to have opinions in the relevant jurisdictions of your counterparties that the closeout netting provisions were enforceable in a bankruptcy of an entity in that jurisdiction, and you had to update those opinions annually. I think Basel II modified the update requirement, but basically you still need to be able to demonstrate to your regulator that you have a contract in place, it's enforceable, and you know you can, at least you have a strong legal opinion that you can enforce that in a bankruptcy. So one of the things we've done and built up over time are a library of opinions in over 50 jurisdictions around the world now that from local councils saying, yes, you would be able to enforce the closeout netting process and the amount coming out of that process in a bankruptcy proceeding of an entity in that jurisdiction. So whether it's what do we do more most recently? It wasn't the Maldives. It was somewhere off in the Atlantic Ocean. You know, one of the recent ones. We've done Malta. We've done various of the BVI and those types of jurisdictions, as well as, you know, Germany, France, UK, Hong Kong, Japan, China, et cetera. Actually, take it back on China. We don't have an opinion there yet. But that's an essential.
A bigger market than Malta, probably.
Yes, it is. Although you'd be surprised, Malta is kind of an offshore type entity for the European Union, so they have some of the same kind of rules that a Jersey would have with respect to the UK. So your question was on.
So I'm just wondering if there's other ways where the ISDA Master Agreement has kind of a legal relevance or has been adopted by regulators as something that.
Nothing I can think of. I mean, when we talk
about the 2005 bankruptcy, would that sort of, is that written in the same, you know, with the master agreement in mind to further kind of?
You mean the amendments in 2005 to the 1990 bankruptcy law changes?
Yeah, yeah, it seemed to be a kind of a complementary to the contractual netting.
Well, keep in mind the 2005 changes to the bankruptcy code were, as they related to derivatives and other types of financial contracts like repos, were amendments to changes that had been made in 1990 to the bankruptcy code to reflect, that's the first time I think you saw the definition of swap agreement and a recognition that the closeout netting process under a swap agreement would be enforceable. So the 2005 changes were largely reflecting developments in the marketplace over the 15 years since the 1990 law. But the structure of it was really not changed at all. It was just recognizing there were additional contracts, types of contracts, mm-hmm. typically done under an ISDA master agreement, including credit derivatives, equity derivatives. Most people were comfortable, and our opinion certainly confirmed prior to the 2005 amendment, that in a bankruptcy, the master agreement encompassing equity derivatives and credit derivatives ought to be enforceable in a bankruptcy proceeding. The 2005 amendments gave additional statutory comfort and support for that legal conclusion, but the legal conclusion was already firmly there in our opinions, which we obtained from counsel. So that's the way to think about the 2005 bankruptcy law.
You guys pushed
it was an amendment,
hard, right?
We certainly did.
So I mean, there must have been some sense that there was a benefit from it.
It absolutely, we pushed it in 1990. We began pushing those changes beginning in 1996, I think it was. The legislation, how that happens, it took 10 years to get to the point where they made those amendments to confirm what I think was generally acknowledged would be enforceable.
That wasn't the contentious part of the bankruptcy.
Can I get some water or anything like that?
Sure. Is there
water
here?
Is there? Yeah.
Keep going. Okay. We're it's kind of a new.
Just trying to understand the regulatory environment, and you know, it's described as an unregulated sector. In general, would you agree that it's that derivative over the counter derivatives are unregulated, or would you say? Self-regulated? How would you describe it?
The fundamental building block of this business mm-hmm. is that bilateral, privately negotiated transaction. Mm-hmm. Two parties coming together, deciding they want to, you know, one wants to buy, one wants to sell, one wants to pay fixed, one wants to pay floating. Mm-hmm. That's the fundamental building block. To our mind, that's a question of freedom of contract. Mm-hmm. Parties ought to be free to enter into that contract. So then the question is, you know, are one or the other entities involved in that contract, you know, should they be subject to some type of supervision as it relates to their business, including that contract? Mm-hmm. So our focus has traditionally been on having in place effective banking supervisors, in mm-hmm. the case of the investment banks, the SEC, you know, various supervisors around the world, and we have very close working relationships with many supervisors mm-hmm. In all the major jurisdictions. And I think they understand that, you know, these contracts, the value that these contracts provide, but they also understand that you know, for entities who are going to be dealing in these contracts, perhaps building up significant positions or at least building up a lot of activity, keep in mind a lot of the dealers are largely flat in their derivatives book. You know, they may be a little long, a little short at any particular time, but they're largely flat. But nevertheless, because of the role that they play in the marketplace, yes, they should be overseen mm-hmm. Effectively as to their derivatives business, mm-hmm. in addition to other business that they may do by the supervisors. And we've certainly been strong advocates of that institutional regulation.
And with respect to derivative dealing exposures, what are the key components of that a supervisory framework should have?
We often refer back to there have been various groups and studies and things over the years. We refer back to the Group of 30 report published in 1993, I think it was, that lays out, you know, the considerations that's really focused on what I think companies who are looking to deal in derivatives should have in place in terms of, mm-hmm. you know, the proper review process, oversight by senior management, all mm-hmm. those very important things. And I think that those are clear indications of where the supervisors should focus. Mm-hmm. I think supervisors should be focused on significant exposures of the entity that they supervise. Mm-hmm. They should probably have a good understanding of the models that are used by the institutions to manage their exposure, to mark their books to market, to make their collateral calls, to value their positions. Mm-hmm. I think those are some of the fundamental building blocks of appropriate and strong oversight of those institutions.
Many of the players in the market are banks, and they are regulated. Some are bank holding companies, I would assume, and they are supervised, regulated. Before the SEC began its CSE program, I assume that Goldman and the other large investment banks were participating. How
yes.
were they, in what sense were they supervised then? Was this, there was no supervision there, I would take it.
Well, there was, it depends on how they ended up doing their business.
If they didn't do it through the broker-dealer, but if they did it through
they had this program, which I think a couple of the banks used, which was this so-called broker-dealer light, which came into place, I think, in 1998 and was used by at least a couple of the investment banks, which gave some oversight to the SEC for their business. I don't know which of those investment banks were, you know, using the broker-dealer light process. Mm-hmm. And I'm not as familiar with the oversight generally of the investment banks.
The supervision was of the entity and not of the market.
That's right. And that, you know, again, if we go back to the basic building block, mm-hmm. Some of the traditional notions of a security just don't apply in that case. You know, there's not one party who's handing over money to the other in the expectation of some kind of return, that, you know, that other entity is going to manage that in some way, whether that's where you lend money via a bond, or you invest in a company where that's a more classic security definition. That transaction, you know, may not involve any security at all. It may involve an interest rate or a currency or whatever. And neither party is handing over money to the other. They're just agreeing to, at least on the day of the trade, is essentially an at-the-money trade, mm-hmm. at-the-market trade. And the relative exposure of the two parties will fluctuate over time based on where that contract stands versus the market price. So one party at any point in time after the contract is done will be considered to be in the money in a gain position, and the other will be out of the money in a loss position, mm-hmm. if the contract were to terminate on that date. But if you look over the life of the contract, the parties get the benefit of the bargain, mm-hmm. by virtue of the contract that they agreed to.
I guess, over the years, we've heard that the New York Fed has kind of played a role in this market when there haven't been other supervisors to kind of step in. And I guess the two places we've heard were in the mid-90s. We were told by one fellow that the very first is the master agreements were a response to the New York Fed saying something needs to be done. And then more recently, of course, the New York Fed helped clean up the novations, the assignments that have been where there was a backlog in order confirmations. Do you agree with, if we were to characterize it, this market as kind of lightly regulated with the New York Fed occasionally stepping in? Would you describe it differently?
I don't know that I'd quite put it in those terms. Again, as I mentioned, we have good, strong, as an organization, we have mm-hmm. good, strong working relationships with supervisors around the world, and I would put the New York Fed mm-hmm. certainly in that camp and uh-huh. very, very near the top of that camp. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the reference to some comment about the ISDA master agreement being created in response. I just don't think that's true. If you go back, if you want to look more brief, if you want a brief history of ISDA documentation,
which we have time for, please a brief one.
But there have been three master agreements published over time. Mm-hmm. The first was published in 1987. There are actually two versions of it. One was called the Interest Rate and Currency Exchange Agreement. The other was called the Interest Rate Swap Agreement. Mm-hmm. That Interest Rate and Currency Exchange Agreement was the precursor to the other two because it was a cross-border contract to govern. The Interest Rate Swap Agreement was just focused on U.S. dollar interest rate swaps. The other document contemplated being used cross-border.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think in 1987 there was any comment from the New York Fed that would have... So I think of that as the first master. There was a master then put in place in 1992, mm-hmm. which was clearly structured to be the sole master agreement the parties would use and would be used cross-border. And that's really the basis on which the ISDA documentation structure grew over the subsequent 10 years. We did publish a 2002 master agreement, which was partly just a bringing up to date of various provisions. It also reflected experiences mm-hmm. with the Asian currency crisis, with LTCM in terms of being able to close out in an effective way, a more effective way based on those experiences. Mm-hmm. So those have been the three milestone dates in the master agreement development. I wouldn't tie any of those in particular to comments made by regulators.
Or any regulator, okay.
No. I mean, again, they were all well aware of the developments. We certainly, maintained, tried to keep the information flow going, but it wasn't in response to that, no.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. We were talking about the difference between regulating entities and regulating markets. It seemed like that was part of the issue at stake in the 2000 Commodity Futures Modernization Act, previously when you were exempted but not excluded from the CEA, you were hypothetically covered as a market and not as just the entities in the market. Do you think the CMFA has made the markets more stable and resulted in the kind of results that you're looking for?
Well, I think the motivation behind the CFMA, from our perspective, was what we refer to as legal certainty. There was a question that people raised about whether transactions, swap transactions could be considered to be illegal off-exchange futures. And so we were eager to, answer that question once and for all, which I think the CFMA did. It also provided regulatory reform to the exchanges. And so you see post-CFMA significant growth in both OTC business and significant growth in the exchange-traded business. To some extent, that's clearly to some extent a function of the CFMA. It's also a function of what I mentioned before in terms of the OTC derivative dealers often being the biggest customers for the exchanges. So more business done here means more business done there, and it just kind of can be a beneficial relationship between those two.
Do you think in any way it hampered the earlier introduction of a better treatment of collateral in the market, or better reporting requirements, or perhaps more clear prohibitions against market misconduct?
I think that the ball was already rolling significantly on the usage of collateral in the derivatives business. We published our first standard documentation for use for collateral in 1994, and it was already being used in the interdealer market fairly extensively by 1999-2000. Our first of our it wasn't our full-blown margin survey, but post-LTCM we did a survey, and we can get you a copy of that.
I think those are all on your website.
Yeah, so that was kind of the
from
initial
2000,
one.
I think was the first.
Yeah, I think the first quote-unquote margin survey was 2000. There was something we did, I think, in 1999. I can find it on the website. That was a more limited polling, but of the dealer community in terms of their usage of collateral. So I think people understood then the benefits of collateral, both from a credit risk management standpoint. Of course, it's a powerful tool for that, but also as kind of a discipline in the trading relationship. As you see your exposures change, and you see securities or cash go out the door or come in the door, that has a real effect on your appetite for risk and your managing that risk. So I think in the dealer community it was already being used, but I think if you map the surveys from that first formal one in 2000 until the more recent one, you'll see continued usage of collateral, continued uptake of the documentation. I think it was not until, maybe several years ago where the collateral traditionally has kind of a negative connotation from a credit risk standpoint. If I'm asking you for collateral, you're thinking, why doesn't he trust me to pay him back? And so a lot of companies who, had been asked for collateral might have resisted that. I think that people have overcome that because they understand that it provides discipline, and particularly if it's two-way collateral, it could move between either party. I think it does provide that discipline, and people appreciate that now and understand that. So now I think the entities that don't use collateral are typically, governments, supranationals, AAA rated companies, although that's changing certainly post the experience with AIG.
We're of course supposed to look into the causes of the financial crisis. You have to keep that in mind. And Greg mentioned contagion in his opening statement. And I'm wondering your thought about the relationship between, say, credit default swaps, which have been designated as problematic in that sense, and the financial crisis. How would you respond to that question if someone said to you, what role did credit default swaps have in the financial crisis?
I think the area that needs to be focused on there, and I know, I'm sure you are, as it relates to credit default swaps, is the AIG situation and their usage of credit default swaps. I should kind of up front on, and we could talk about AIG at length, a lot of my awareness of what went on at AIG really comes from, and I don't know if you've read it, the testimony in March 2009 of Scott Polakoff before the Senate Banking Committee. He really went into a lot of detail in terms of the decisions they made and how they managed their risk or didn't manage their risk effectively. So a lot of what I would say here, I think you can see echoed in those remarks from the. He was the acting supervisor, I think, of the OTS.
What was the month?
I think it was March 2009.
We'll get it.
We have it.
Oh, you do? Good.
So. And what went on in AIG? I mean, one has to, they use credit default swaps. They use credit default swaps extensively. Mm-hmm. That wasn't their sole mechanism to take on that exposure to subprime risk. They had a significant securities lending business, which he refers to in that testimony, which was taking on, risk in a comparable amount in that business. So they were eager to take on that risk because they wanted that high risk and presumably high return. What I think compounded that was, on these credit default swaps, they were selling protection on typically these super senior tranches of these CDOs, and they were also doing trades with respect to European banks for capital reasons. So that was kind of the two pieces of it. Mm-hmm. I think with respect to those super senior tranches, you've probably seen the quote from Joseph Cassano about, couldn't imagine losing a dollar on these trades. Well, that what really caught them was the mark-to-market position of those trades. I don't really know what has been paid out on those trades, but the payouts have not been significant in amount, certainly not compared to the mark-to-market exposure that changed. They traded based on their AAA rating and resisted requests to provide collateral because they said, "Hey, we're AAA. Why would we provide collateral?" So you see that attitude, and then they also compounded things by agreeing to provide collateral in the event that they lost that AAA rating. So at the worst possible time, when they lose the rating, they got to come up with the collateral. Banking supervisors, for instance, they don't prohibit that, but they frown on their regulated institutions agreeing to those types of downgrade provisions for just that reason. So, you had all those factors coming together.
To say, is there anything in the CSA that also discourages those kind of acceleration clauses in a CSA?
No, there's nothing in by CSA you mean our credit support
annex.
Yeah. There's nothing in the credit support annex that, gives one indication or the other. I mean, that's typically a negotiated provision between two parties based on their own creditworthiness and their own appetite for, you know, providing collateral. So that's really left to the parties to negotiate. That's not part of the standard form.
Because it occurs to me that Enron had the same problem. A lot of the timing of its filing for bankruptcy was because they were downgraded and get hit with margin calls on that Friday, and that's why they had to declare bankruptcy on Sunday. Mm-hmm. It's because they weren't going to be able to make the margin calls on Monday. Mm-hmm. And so it was a similar kind of accelerating effect, where the downgrades are requiring you kind of late in the game come up with capital when you're obviously capital short and it's downgrade. And so it's a kind of accelerates a problem.
Well, and that's why I say, you know, for instance, the banking supervisors, again, they don't prohibit it, but they frown upon it, and I think if their regulated institution were considering it, they would want to know why are you thinking about doing that? Because those are exactly the wrong time to be chasing around to come up with collateral.
Would your annual surveys have showed what parties had those types of collateral provisions, both the downgrade and the mark-to-market?
No, we don't collect information on the specifics of individual parties' contracts. No.
Would ISDA have any knowledge on how typical or atypical it was for the individual negotiated contracts to have provisions requiring the posting of collateral on mark-to-market declines in the value?
I don't believe so. We'd really have to look at the... But I don't think that's a question we typically ask in the survey.
Yeah, you do ask questions about reapplication, which is a negotiated one of the negotiated features in the credit agreement.
Right.
Perhaps
right.
It could be added to ask them if they've got those sort of acceleration clauses.
Right.
Would
mm-hmm.
be a useful information to know how common or rare it was.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Trying to put AIG in the context of the broader market, it would certainly be helpful for us to have a better understanding of how common those collateral provisions were.
Right. Mm-hmm. You know, I think one thing you could look at in the surveys, which is asked, I think, is, you know, the extent to which, first of all, the extent of collateral usage generally, which as in the market generally is roughly 2/3 of exposure is collateralized. In the inter-dealer market, for most product types, and this is all in the survey, you know, it's more in the 90% level of exposure that's collateralized. So there's that. Also, I think we do ask questions about if it's two-way collateral, meaning one-way versus two-way. One-way is where one party is obligated to post collateral, but the other party may not be. Generally, certainly any active user, two parties who are active in dealing with each other would typically have two-way collateral because they have a lot of positions on, price fluctuations will leave, you know, exposures going back and forth, and you'll want the ability to have that discipline applying to both parties. And so the extent of usage of two-way collateral would be another good indication that those are better practices in the marketplace.
One way to get to the contagion issue would be just using AIG and say, what would have happened if you could explain, not a prediction, but simply go through the steps that would have occurred had AIG been allowed to fail. What then would have happened to the market as a whole, and how and why?
Yeah,
not numbers. We don't need numbers. Just
as far as the market as a whole. We'll put that to the side. I mean, I guess I would focus on just the process of what would have happened with respect to AIG and all their counterparties. Mm-hmm. Now, AIG, you know, they use credit default swaps through the FP division. First of all, it's a question of which AIG entities might have gone into bankruptcy, because AIG also would be an extensive user. AIG parent corporation is probably, I don't know this for sure, but they would be users of interest rate and currency, particularly AIG, being an international organization like that, would be using currency derivatives extensively as well. That's all in their financial statements, which I'd refer to mm-hmm. for all the details on that. Anyway, assuming it's one of those entities or several
of
those entities.
Let's just use FP and the obligations that they created.
Right.
They
would have gone bankrupt.
They've gone bankrupt.
The parties would have had their counterparties, mm-hmm. whether it's the credit default swap counterparties they had or anybody who's a counterparty to it is the master agreement, would be able, they would have a right, they don't have an obligation to pull the plug, but they would typically, as we saw with the Lehman situation, they would typically move to terminate the contracts that they had, to terminate the master agreement they have, including all the transactions under that master agreement, and move to value those positions so that they could put a claim in against the bankruptcy state of AIG, either put a claim in for money that they feel that they're owed under their master agreement, or pay in money that they determined that they owed AIG by virtue of the termination of the positions. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, mechanically what would occur. Now, what happens for all those entities, they either in order to value the positions or to rehedge positions, they would go out into the marketplace and look to replicate those transactions at that time, if they could. And if they couldn't, they would have to come up with an estimation of that based on the actual loss that they suffered as a result of that. So you'd have people go into the marketplace to get new transactions put on or to get quotations for transactions in order to value their positions. That could be a volatile market. That week in particular was a volatile market. But that would be the process that parties would go through. They would look to replace the transactions that they had with a new transaction that gave them the same economics. And to the extent that it was a better deal, the replacement deal, they'd have to pay over the benefit into the estate. To the extent it was a worse deal than what they had with AIG, they'd have a claim against AIG for that differential. So it's a basic kind of cover concept, if you will, in the law. You've lost the benefit of this bargain, you've got to replace it with a new bargain, and to the extent you're worse off, you have a claim against them. To the extent you're better off, you pay them.
Now, let's assume that what they were covering were these portfolios of CDOs. And where were they in that situation? Whatever exposure they had to these CDOs was now covered by AIG. AIG now fails. They have a claim against AIG, but what happens to the obligation now? That exposure goes back on their balance sheet?
It would go back on the balance sheet of the entity because it was I'm assuming, and I haven't looked at the, like, Merrill Lynch's financial mm-hmm. statements. They would have hedged that exposure by virtue of the credit default swap, and they would have reported their positions, for financial purposes, reflecting that hedge. Mm-hmm. When that hedge goes away, they no longer can report. Obviously, with the benefit of that hedge, they have to report as they would have reported without the hedge. And so that's where they would have been. Now, if they could have rehedged, they would be back in the same position. But they would have come back on the financial statements of the buyer of protection from AIG.
So to the extent that there would have been contagion, it would have come from the fact that they were then weaker unless they could rehedge. That is the counterparties, the ones who were protected by AIG.
That's right. They would have.
That's the contagion. That if there was contagion, that would have been the contagion.
I'm not sure exactly what you mean by contagion.
Well, I'm not sure exactly what people mean by contagion either, but the idea is that I'm trying to figure out what it is that. Here's how I would analyze a credit default swap causing contagion, and that is. All these parties had moved through this arrangement, had moved this exposure off their balance sheet to the balance sheet of AIG. Mm-hmm. So they were that much stronger in the sense that they didn't have that obligation anymore. Now it comes back on their balance sheet, so they are weaker. Mm-hmm. That is how I would interpret contagion. Is that reasonable? Is to say, I mean, I'm assuming they can't hedge again.
I guess that's your definition of contagion. Yes, that's probably right. I guess I just look at it as take a snapshot before the AIG bankruptcy and a snapshot after the AIG bankruptcy. What's different in the picture? The difference is before the AIG bankruptcy, they have this hedge position. After the AIG bankruptcy, they don't have it. And that has financial statement effects.
Well, I mean, it could be something that they had on the balance sheet as a dollar and now it's at 60 cents. If that's what the market tells them to do.
Sorry.
I mean, they might have to mark it down immediately as soon as they lose the hedge.
Well, that's right.
I meant that as a question.
Right. Yeah. That's right. They would have, whatever the, they would have had to put on their books the market value of that position, whereas previously, from their perspective, they, the market value of, I mean, that's inherent in the nature of derivative, is that the market value is, you know, that transaction, one party's up, the other party's down, one party's in the money, one party's out of the money, and they didn't have to worry about that fluctuation because they had hedged the position.
Right.
When the hedge goes off, they have to worry about that fluctuation.
Do you think the transparency was sufficient? I mean, would it have been better if investors had known a little more detail about the exposure of well, whatever companies we're talking about, Goldman to AIG, in the event that this happened?
You know, there's a lot of, you know, the thing about derivatives and the financial statements of companies like that, I mean, there's a lot of information in those financial statements. And I, you know, if you look at the AIG's financial statements, you could see how that risk was building up over the 2002 to 2005/6 period. If you look at the, if you look at the financial statements, you could get, well, you wouldn't get that kind of level of detail as to a specific counterparty. You'd see Goldman's overall, you know, derivative position. You may get, they may break out in some respects their credit default swap positions. Wouldn't be as specific as to particular counterparties. I know in some of the, if you look at some of the financial statements of Merrill Lynch earlier in 2008, you would see kind of a breakdown of their purchase of credit default swaps with respect to different tranches of CDOs that they had. I think that's one of the things that, you know, is part of these ongoing interaction with the Fed and other global regulators through the Fed in terms of commitments regarding information on positions that, you know, for instance, on credit default swaps, you can see, the public can see via the DTCC website, you know, how much protection is written on particular counterparties, sorry, particular reference entities.
Right, right.
The regulators have access to that information and would, are in a position to, you know, look at the details of not only what the exposure is, but who that who's buying and selling that exposure.
I mean, that helps if you've got, you're worried about an excess of maybe trading activity in relationship to the amount of outstanding referenced securities. If you've got more credit default swaps and bonds in the, what was that, Delphi case or something like that.
Right.
But what it doesn't tell you is, like, I just bought credit protection from AIG. I don't know they've already sold $500 billion of credit protection. You know, the last... The last $50 million of protection seems a little less valuable than the first $50 million of protection. I'm just guessing. And so that's just what might be considered material information that the markets didn't have.
Well, I think, you know, as it relates to, you know, I think this goes back to the effectiveness of risk management at the individual firms and the supervision of those entities by the supervisors. I think, you know, firms did, you know, AIG was a willing seller, and generally people were willing buyers. And you
good
know,
price.
Yeah, and frankly, I think they should have figured, if I've bought X billion dollars of protection from AIG, I got to figure the other 8 or 9 or 10 or 15 guys on the street are buying a similar amount, and therefore... You know, whatever information I'm getting from AIG, I've got to take into account that they're probably an active seller across the market. I think that the individual regulators of each of those entities probably was aware or could have made itself aware of what those entities had taken on in terms of exposure to AIG. But if the SEC is looking at the Goldman book, or and you know the OCC is looking at what Bank A's book and you know, the OTS is looking, I don't know, you know, which other banking regulator, there's not that kind of aggregation of information, which I think through the combination of the data repository, the DTCC in this case, and also this, you know, council of regulators that is proposed in the legislation, you would have an ability and a need, an imperative to connect those dots and determine where that risk is building up.
So DTCC, I mean, I think they had that data as early as 06, I'm not sure when they started providing it to the regulators, but I mean, is that something that might have been more helpful to the markets if they made it public earlier?
Well, I think it was made, the website went live in November of 2008. Mm-hmm. The information, you'd have to talk to them about when they may have begun to give the regulators some indication of what was, you know, what was there. Mm-hmm. Although even then, at that time, although now they collect information on credit default swap protection written on CDOs, at that time they were not collecting the information as it related to the AIG-type trade.
When someone buys information from, say, an AIG, I tend to think of it as becoming exposed to AIG.
That's counterparty credit risk. That's a fundamental part of
credit risk.
Derivatives, yes.
And so would they probably, you don't deal in the market, so maybe you don't know this, but maybe you have heard about it. I would assume that when they go to AIG to answer Randall's question, they ask questions about, or they know, what exposure AIG already has, don't they?
They should be. They should be asking those questions. I mean, it's a fundamental credit issue, and one of the risks that we certainly identify in connection with engaging in OTC derivative transactions, and again, it's one of the reasons we exist as an organization, is that you create credit risk by virtue of entering into that trade, counterparty credit risk. Mm-hmm. And so you need to manage that effectively, and the threshold way to manage that is make sure you know who your counterparty is, what their exposures are. You know, they're not going to tell you who they've written protection with, but they should be able to tell you we're at this level, and you ought to be asking those questions.
Right.
Then you've got mechanisms like the ISDA master agreement, like our credit support documents, that are also means of managing that counterparty credit risk. But the threshold issue is really knowing your counterparty and kicking the tires.
So one thing we know about is what the dealers actually say to one another, or what the people who are trading in this market actually say to one another about what they have in the way of liabilities or exposure to others, right?
Yeah, to the extent they're finding out that information. Yeah.
If they're diligent.
One thing that was an interesting part of the AIG situation is that they all negotiated for unconditional guarantees from the parent company. So I think they probably all saw their counterparty as AIG.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, they're all to the credit.
Is that typical to have guarantees? In that, do you know?
It
that's
varies.
A
really,
part of the
that's
a, that, that,
no, certainly not anything that's that comes from ISDA, but that's part of the credit analysis you do. If you look at if it's company A that wants to do business with you, and you look at company A and you say, I'm not sure I want to do business with you, but you got that nice big company up above you that owns you. If you can give us a guarantee from that company, then we can deal with you. But then you're really taking on the credit exposure of the big company up above.
A related question. Two questions before I get to the penultimate question. But you mentioned in 2002 there was a new master agreement.
New master agreement, yes.
I'm not familiar with it, but what would there be any reason in late 2003 and 2004 for major dealers to go ahead and enter the 1992 master agreement instead of the 2002 agreement?
Inertia and client preferences. It was true to some extent even in 1992, shifting over from the 87 to the 92. It happened quicker, but
why would the AIG, for instance, with a major dealer on the other side, prefer the 1992 if they would? Or I don't know what they preferred, but I know they did enter it. After 2002,
they did. I don't know.
Would there be any reason to do that?
Again, I think familiarity, inertia. Hey, we're doing this with our other dealer counterparties. Why not do there?
Question a little differently. Would anything have been significantly better had they been operating under the 2002 master agreement?
No. The fundamental process that I described a little earlier in terms of closing out the positions against AIG financial products that we were speculating about obviously didn't come to pass, but fundamentally it wouldn't have been different. The major difference that would have relate there between 92 and 2002 is the way in which we value the transactions would be slightly different, probably not in a major way. 92 required you to, if you could, to go out and get market quotations from several different people. If you couldn't get market quotations, and frankly I doubt you would have been able to get market quotations for those trades, you'd then fall back on this loss concept. And that, the 2002 formulation provided a little bit more leeway in terms of the non-defaulting party to value positions using market inputs and not direct market quotations. But I can't imagine the result would have been vastly different under the 2002 versus the 92, but that's speculation on my part.
And then the follow-up question to some of the things that the commissioner and others had asked. The credit support annex, the ISDA credit support annex, relies somewhat on Moody's and S&P. Any lessons learned? And is that set to change? Is, I follow Peter's question. I mean, it envisions looking at those credit ratings and having different attachment points based on those ratings falling.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's the case. Okay. Do you have the credit? I mean, if you want to have a copy of the credit support annex, if you have the form credit support annex, if you have a copy of what AIG or whoever negotiated, a lot of those provisions will be specific to the negotiation between AIG and its counterparty and wouldn't be part of our standard form. Largely, we, on questions of how you value, we don't do anything in terms of how you value, I don't think in the document, because that's really a proprietary to the parties. And then there's a question of, you know, the securities that you do take. I mean, a lot of what people take is cash. Treasuries, so there's really not a haircut. In some cases, people will take other types of collateral, which they would apply some haircut to, which might be ratings based, but that's not something we would get into in terms of our standard form.
Okay.
So if you see,
I guess it's a schedule to the.
Yeah,
scene,
I mean, can I just
sure.
confirm that if you don't mind?
Yep.
Yeah. So
yep.
If we look at this, the 18 pages here for standard form. They have actually, I think they've actually retyped our schedule, so you have to compare it to our pre-printed form. You know, it all looks basically familiar, but there are a lot of provisions in here that they've added on a negotiated basis. If you then go to the credit support, in this Appendix A, that's the form of guarantee with AIG parent. And then if you go to the credit support annex, the 10 pages are our standard form, pre-printed form.
So it's the Schedule A.
The schedule looks also to be kind of retyped, although, you know, in structure, what we've published, but again, very much tailored to the two parties, which is, you know, the fundamental feature of OTC derivatives.
So does ISDA have any guidance at all or lessons learned regarding credit rating agencies?
We have not published anything or made any statements regarding that. I'll also say that the rating agencies are members of the organization. So
can we just test the hypotheses that we've been looking at for how derivatives may have contributed to the financial crisis?
Sure.
May I ask one follow-up question
sure.
for Ted Thomas? I'll be fast.
Sure.
This is something, I think it relates a little bit to the contagion point. It was an example you raised earlier about CDS being the perfect example of banks that have a credit exposure. It's being the end user that sort of starts that ball rolling, and then everyone involved in the chain is sort of there laying off risk. And everyone in your example actually held risk that it wanted to hedge through the use of credit default swaps. I'm curious to know if ISDA has any data or if you have a view of the use of credit default swaps, not to lay off actual risk that you hold, but to, for lack of a better way of describing it, place bets on events in the markets that you believe may or may not happen, and people taking long and short sides of those bets without actually holding the risk that they're laying off through CDS.
Mm. We don't have any data on that. Taking the example you laid out, I mean, the dealer who sold the original protection could look to a few different ways in which to manage that risk. They could find another company that has the opposite exposure. Not likely, because it's just, you know, kind of bespoke. In the credit default swap space, there has not been an exchange traded alternative. So you would the dealer would typically turn either to another dealer or to a hedge fund who may be looking to speculate on a position, or some entity who wants to take on exposure to a particular entity or sector that it couldn't take on directly. Yeah. So sometimes people want to have exposure to the automobile sector or the oil sector, generally speaking, and instead of lending to that sector, they may take on that. This is an investor who's looking for return, will sell protection, therefore taking on the credit exposure to that sector, and they can do that via an index trade versus as well as a single name trade on a particular company. So that does occur, but in terms of any specific statistics.
But there's nothing. There's no requirement in the ISDA contracts or in the framework that ISDA set up for dealing in these types of derivatives for either party to hold any risk that it's laying off through the credit default swap. I mean, it could be the case that both parties don't hold risk that they're laying off.
It could be the case that both parties are don't have direct risk. Keep in mind, though, we've talked about a couple of types of risks, and there are other ones that that a credit derivative could be quite useful for. The fundamental purpose would be the bond or the loan. I've lent money to a company, I got credit exposure, I buy protection so that I can hedge that. I'm the seller of that protection, and I want to hedge that in some way. So those are the two examples that we've talked about so far. I may be a supplier to a particular company, and therefore I'm expecting to get paid from them.
But ISDA hasn't done any. I understand where, yeah. But ISDA hasn't done any analysis of the use of derivatives in the non-hedging market or separating those two worlds out.
We haven't done a formal study. I mean, we may have made comments on that in a testimony or something like that, but I couldn't point you to that offhand.
I guess this is sort of a follow-up question before you get to that, because I think Dixie's question raised something for me, and that is the so-called naked swaps issue. I mean,
right, that's really what I was trying to describe. Yeah. Thank you.
This is the naked swaps issue, I think, mm-hmm. and that mm-hmm. is, do you see any value in the market, to the market, from people, I won't use the term betting, I'll use the term speculating, mm-hmm. about the credit of someone who they have no connection to in any way.
Yeah, I think that the role of speculators is to provide a lot of liquidity to a market. I don't think that in the credit default swap space, we don't have numbers on that, but I don't think that the portion of entities that are have absolutely no possible exposure. And again, I guess you'd be talking about a buyer of protection in that situation who have no exposure. That they would be, I don't think that's a significant part of the market. And, they're providing liquidity to the marketplace by going in and saying that the price at which credit is currently being offered is either cheap or expensive, and I'm willing to, put some money behind that. But as I said before, what gets the ball rolling in these markets, at least, is that ultimate exposure to entities that actually have the risk.
The two broad categories of hypotheses that derivatives could have been involved in the crisis are in some way that credit derivatives helped in some way to magnify the mortgage bubble in the first place. The second category, which I'll let Randall do, is contagion, which is a very imprecise word, and we try to explain what we mean by it whenever we say it. In terms of the first one, which is the mortgage market, I mean, I guess it's pretty well established that the CDO market, the cash CDO market, was a big purchaser of the BBB and other investment grade tranches of RMBS. We'd like to try to figure out a way to prove or disprove this, but it certainly seems that without the CDO, the MBS market would have been a lot different. In turn, this cash CDO market was facilitated in many ways by credit default swaps. And you've got AIG with providing the CDS protection. It's impossible to know whether there would have been buyers without AIG and other monoline and others providing the protection. But it's certainly fair to say that a lot of buyers relied on AAA and AA counterparties to use credit default swaps to offload the credit risk. Similarly, in the equity tranches of cash CDOs still, it appears that it was very common for the hedge funds who bought those tranches to turn around and short via CDS mezzanine tranches of something else, whether it's an index or a synthetic CDO. So in some way, credit default swaps seem to have been involved in keeping this market going for some time, after which, arguably, it should have stopped. It shouldn't have been going. And then the second bundle of arguments is the synthetic CDO itself, and that somehow kept the market going beyond its useful life. Do you have an opinion on these theories?
Yeah, I guess I would. First of all, as it relates to most of those pieces of the scenario you lay out, they are securities. They're CDOs, even synthetic CDOs are offered as securities with offering circulars, et cetera, et cetera. Not that anybody necessarily read them, but but there are securities, and there, whatever the issues there regarding disclosure, sophistication of the investor, suitability, all those types of things are ultimately securities law issues. And I'm not here to know where I report to be an expert on securities laws. So I think that's important to keep in mind. I think that as far as credit default swaps, and let me before we talk about it as it relates to some of those transactions, let me contrast what's going on in a credit default swap from a hedging or laying off risk perspective versus what's happening with the securitization world. In the securitization world, you have banks lending money, maybe more on mortgage debt. They are therefore they're taking on that credit exposure. They're looking at ways to lay off that risk. The securitization world allowed them. Securitization is an important market. It's going to be important to get that up and running effectively again. But to understand what's going on there, you have the banks laying off all of that into a special purpose vehicle, bankruptcy remote special purpose vehicle, and then selling ABS, notes to investors. So they're getting the risk off their books into the SPV. They're probably the manager or the underwriter for the offering of the ABS, so they're getting a fee on the underwriting. They are probably also the manager of the, they're providing a management service to the SPV to manage the debt that's in the SPV, right? So they're probably getting a management fee. So, they get it off their books, no longer have the credit exposure, start generating fees from the underwriting and from the management. Contrast that with a credit default swap, where you don't buy credit default swaps on an individual mortgage borrower, but so look at it as a company. You've lent money to a company, and let's say you want to buy a credit default swap for all of that loan that you made. It's often not the case. The banks often will hedge a piece of it with a credit default swap. They may hold on to some of it. But let's say they hedge the whole thing. They have economically offset their exposure. They still have the relationship, with the borrower. When the borrower says, I'm having trouble making my payments, they're still calling the same bank, the same banking officer that they've always had. So there's that relationship that's still there, although economically they've hedged the position. But they've two critical differences with the securitization world. They bought the protection. What they've now done, they may have hedged their credit exposure to that borrower, but they've taken on credit exposure to the seller of protection. And that's an important differential. So they've got that exposure now, and they're paying money for it. They're paying a fee to that seller of protection in order to be able to lay off that risk. So I think it's important to understand those. That's not exactly what you were getting at in your questions, but I think it's important to understand those distinctions between what's going on in a securitization / CDO world versus what's happening in a what I would call a pure CDS world. So you've got entities who are entering into those transactions or buying those particular tranches, and you know, they're looking at that risk. And yes, if they want to manage that risk in some way effectively, a CDS is going to be an attractive means to do that. It's not a cost-free means of doing it. It's not a risk-reducing. It's just a risk-shifting mechanism. So I think, to that extent, I don't really see it as the fuelant that you know, people have suggested.
Well, I guess one of the arguments, at least if I can formulate it, is when you have a synthetic CDO that is.
I think
you know what I'm getting at.
But that's the synthetic is the second piece. I was focusing a little bit more on the first piece.
Yeah, so they're a little intertwined, but yeah.
Okay.
Go ahead. So, well, I think you know what the question is then. Did synthetic CDOs, to the extent that they made it possible for people to take on this risk, enhance the risk in the market, whereas it would have come to a halt, as Greg was suggesting, without once they ran out of product?
I think that's what are called cash
RMBAs.
Cash CDOs. Yeah, I think what you've, we haven't talked about this, you know, kind of factor, which I'm sure you're looking at in the review of the financial crisis, is, you know, low interest rates. You know, whatever your view is to the reason for that, whether that was the Fed policies, whether that was a global imbalance that led to low interest rates or whatever. Low interest rates mean that parties are going to be even more incentivized, investors are going to be even more incentivized to explore areas that provide higher return. And higher return will mean higher risk strategies. That's certainly true. And so I think you did see that kind of iteration. That led to, you know, that what you describe, RMBS CDOs. You know, you've got the CDO squares, which are basically CDOs of CDOs, where people were putting in the tranches of CDOs into another CDO. And I do think that, you know, synthetic CDOs provided a mechanism, again, via a securities route, you know, with all the relevant issues of disclosure and suitability and sophistication of the parties. But those investors were eager to get instruments that were going to provide them an enhanced return. And, you know, for better or for worse, Wall Street is good at providing those kinds of, you know, responding to those client demands by coming up with products that do offer those types of returns.
Here's a question that I haven't been able to answer.
I should say, though, that while the CDO that would be part of the synthetic CDO, the CDS that would be part of the CDO would be typically documented under an ISDA master agreement between the, you know, between the investor and the SPV, or between the SPV and the buyer of protection. That's not something that we didn't publish standardized documentation for the securities piece of that. We did have documentation for credit default swaps on ABS, and subsequent to that, I think credit default swaps on CDOs. But that's more along the lines of what the monolines and the, that's more the first piece of what you were talking about, Greg, instead of the second piece, which is the synthetic CDO.
What I haven't been able to get clear in my own mind is whether this actually increased risk or just shifted it, because there's only one loss. It's the loss on the real thing, the RMBS, we'll say, that has been made turned into a synthetic instrument of some kind by trying to duplicate it, but only. I'm not articulating this very well, but is there more than one loss here, or did we multiply the losses, or have we just spread the same loss to a number of different parties?
It's in the nature of the product. But I think that, you know, derivatives shift risk; they don't create risk. But what I think we saw with the securities that you're referring to, you know, there you had investors who were standing to lose, you know, an investment that they made, mm-hmm. money that they put up or were obligated to put up.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, and they lost that, and that has effects. You know, but there was, on these trades, that money, as I think it's been reported, you know, in some of the transactions, whether it's John Paulson or, you know, some of the other hedge funds who were buying protection, you know, you read the book by Michael Lewis,
mm-hmm.
those people were getting effectively that money. So it is, you know, it is a zero-sum game there.
Mm-hmm.
So there were people who benefited from that.
Yeah.
There were people who lost significantly as a result of that. But I don't think that the losses are 10 times those gains. It's just that...
Well, are they more than one time?
I don't think they're more than one time.
Well, I think this relates a little bit to the question I was trying to ask earlier, which is if you have, for example, an investor in an RMBS or in a CDO, isn't it possible to create a derivative contract that references that RMBS or CDO, where neither of the parties to the derivative are parties to the underlying asset contract, underlying security transaction, right? So in which case, if you have investor in the RMBS, then you also create a derivative transaction where neither party is an investor in the RMBS, then how is that not two losses? If the RMBS loses money and the derivative contract thereby requires the protection seller to pay out to the protection buyer,
I guess I look at it, you know, in terms of the two parties to the derivatives contract, in terms of, you know, as between them, it's a zero sum game.
As between them, yes, but in terms of the larger financial system, there are two losses based on the loss of one underlying asset.
Mm-hmm.
That's possible by virtue of the fact that the derivative contract exists.
I think what Bob is saying is that there's also a winner. There's a loser, but there's a winner for every loser. The only one who's a real loser is
but
the one who's...
Yeah, but if you, you, but that net, but if you look at that, all right, so you have loss in RMBS, the actual security becomes worthless, all right? So there's a loss. On the derivatives, you have a loss and a win, if you will. And so if you net that out, you have one loss, right? So I don't see how that has increased the risk in the system because there's that loss.
Well, maybe beyond the scope of this. I mean, one question is whether if the derivative bet is a leveraged bet and that money wasn't there to begin with, but then it has to be paid out. I think, it's a theory.
It's... On one hand, yes.
I will say that it's important to, you know, I think, you know, the synthetic CDOs are certainly an area of focus in terms of, you know, how they played out, in terms of what, how they were used, and how they allowed, you know, more securities to be issued as a result of that.
So I guess a partly related question is this empty creditor hypothesis, and I mean, it's been most clearly illustrated by the trucking case at the end of last year, where allegedly hedge funds were being urged to buy the bonds of a company, but then to take even more credit protection and then do something which resulted in a bigger gain on the default swaps than the loss that they would take on the bonds. I don't need you to comment on that case, but I mean a similar...
But I don't think that actually ended up happening, did it?
As it turned out, I mean, there was a lot of political pressure and attention on it, and then so it didn't happen, right? But it was a good example of what they mean by that hypothesis. I mean, I don't know if this is a common thing or if it's never happened. It's just something I had read about in academic literature in this case illustrated that it could happen. The Magnetar story is similar to that. I mean, the idea is, and maybe the allegation's wrong, but the hypothesis is still there, that you can that you could buy an equity tranche of a CDO and then buy more protections. You're actually incentivized to put in low quality assets into the CDO, and you know that ends up with a question about whether the incentive structure is right.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever.
Yeah, I guess I don't really comment on the Magnetar thing. I don't know enough about how that was structured.
Mm-hmm.
As it relates to the more general empty creditor position, we actually produced a research note on that, which is on our website, but we can get it to you. Henry Hu, who's now over at the SEC, is the most vocal proponent of that view. And we've actually had him speak at our annual meeting, and so, you know, and I know him reasonably well. But we felt it was important to counter some of those assertions, and you'll see that laid out in more detail in the research note. I think our view on the empty creditor issue is that at a superficial level, we understand why people think that's probably the case. But I think when you dig deeper, I'm not sure it really pans out, although I think we would all agree, and I think the note ends up saying, probably worth some additional thought and analysis, consideration. But from our standpoint, it's not so patently obvious once you kind of understand the dynamics of what's going on that the empty creditor is really an issue. And the reason for that is that, you know, you've got, I think some people, you know, when they look at the empty creditor issue, they think it's a situation where, you know, oh yeah, all of a sudden I'm going to buy up a bunch of credit, I'm going to buy one bond and a bunch of credit default swap protection, and all of a sudden, you know, leverage that, go in, dig in my heels with the you know, the restructuring discussions on the bond, and, you know, blow that up and then cash in big on my credit default swaps. It's a very high risk strategy, because if you're doing it at that time, if you're building up that position in a short period of time, you're driving up the cost of the protection you're going to buy every time you do a trade. And this really gets back to that bilateral contract. Every time, if I want to buy that protection, I got to go into the market. Every time I go into the market, it's going to be, you know, bidding up against me. So it's a pretty high risk strategy in that kind of short time frame. It may be the case that if I was smart enough 3 years ago to think that Lehman Brothers, maybe David Einhorn was, but to think that Lehman Brothers was going to go under, and I bought protection really cheap, and I built up a, you know, over time a position, and then I get into negotiations where I can actually prevent a restructuring of the bonds, drive them into bankruptcy and benefit from that. You know, maybe that applies, but, you know, that requires a long-term horizon that I'm not sure really, if you look at the specific circumstances, it is borne out by the facts.
Okay.
Let's go to Rand. Well, I was hoping also, we're a little tight on time, trying to figure out how to best manage it. Could I go back to the question I asked you earlier when you answered it by, you said the CMFA was really about legal certainty. The way to achieve legal certainty was to exclude OTC derivatives from the Commodity Exchange Act, which resulted in them being essentially excluded from market regulation as opposed to institutional regulation. And I was going to ask you, and as a result, there's no regulation on collateral. There's no regulation on market conduct in that market. There's no regulation on how dealers make a market in that area. There's no specialist or designated market makers. So did that work out as intended? Is that, you know, is that result what was hoped for in 2000? Is that a satisfactory result?
I would say yes. And I think the proof of that is in the growth in the business. And again, I mentioned very early on, and we really ought to take a moment to talk about this. The number $600 trillion gets thrown out. I've heard it mentioned in some of the hearings. I don't know where exactly that number comes from, but I'm not quibbling with that. Our numbers, if you add up, I think at the peak, if you add up our interest rate, our survey covers interest rates, currencies, equities, and credit. If you hit the peak of those numbers, which probably was that mid-2008 number, it probably was in the neighborhood of $500 trillion notional amount. For the notion, for these purposes, for what I want to talk about, I'm not sure it makes a big difference whether I'm talking about 500 or 600. What needs to be understood, and I know it's easy to throw that.
It's 500. They added the 70 from the open interest on the exchanges that BIS comes.
Oh, okay.
Up
so
with,
that includes
and
some
that gets 600, and it's a sloppy use of the data. I couldn't agree with you more.
All right. So, but that again is notional amount, which is really tantamount to trading volumes on the exchange, on a stock exchange. It is not the amount of money at risk. And so I think you really need to look at the DTCC numbers, which talk about gross exposure, and even more importantly, after you give effect to the benefits of netting. And I believe the current ratio is like 0.6% of the notional is what is the amount, the netted amount at risk in the OTC derivatives business. So assuming, let's say 500 is correct, because we'll back out that 70 and change, 500 is correct, so it's about $3 trillion of risk as a result of OTC
that's
derivatives.
The market, or that's the market value, that's the net?
That's the net for value of derivatives positions.
And is that 0.6% equivalent across all types of derivatives?
It is largely. I have to look at the details. I'm not sure that the BIS breaks that out by different contracts. Given the credit market volatilities, I think that credit default swaps is probably a higher percent right now. But I'm not talking 20%. I'm talking about maybe it's 2% or something like that. We should probably dig that out from the BIS numbers and see what is provided.
Net value, isn't that? Don't you mean net exposure? You said net value? 0.6% is net value. I'm having trouble figuring out.
Well, net exposure is, I think, from my view, they're equivalent. I guess to think about it is, let's assume every
sense in which you're using the word
let's assume value. Every ISDA master agreement, every OTC derivative terminated today. Mm-hmm. The net flows as a result of that termination, based on recent data and valuations, would be $3 trillion. All right, and that's some people are going to have money coming in, some people are going to have money going out, but that's the net exposure that exists, you have to think, well, okay, what's the prospect of every single derivative contract being terminated in one day? We did a rough calculation in which we can send you an article, which we did in January of 2008, I think it was, in the FT, where we did a rough calculation of the possible, because Bill Gross had said that there was going to be $300 billion of losses from credit default swaps, and we thought that was grossly overstated. Because we laid out a calculation there. If you assume a certain probability of default, if you assume a certain recovery rate on the obligations, and there is some amounts recovered as a result of this, we estimated that the losses from credit default swaps would be approximately $15 billion. And frankly, I don't think that number is very far off from what we've seen from actual losses in credit default swaps since we wrote that article. Keep in mind, we're talking about actual defaults that occurred and payouts that occurred under those contracts. And we've had, going back to 2005, we've had over 50 credit events. And since September of 2008, we've probably had about 40 of those credit events. And those have all been settled in accordance with their terms. Parties have paid up. The sellers of protection have paid. There's not been a blip in the market as a result of that. GM, which for many years had been thought to be, geez, if they go under, it's going to be a real disruption, it happened without a whimper.
Do you have data or information you can provide us on those percentages over time and on the $15 billion that you're talking about? The percentages, I mean, the 0.6%.
Well, look, we can certainly give you the comparable numbers on 0.6. In fact, we can send him that chart that David Mengel puts together every time the BIS and every time the OCC come out with data. He's got a chart that shows the netting benefit over time.
And how time frame do you have that over?
I think that time frame is at least till back to the early 90s.
But you'll see fantastic.
That. You'll see that from the chart itself.
We always like to have accurate
charts.
Data.
Okay, good. Yeah, and then we'd have to look at the details of the BIS report to see if it breaks out.
Can you break
CDS
it? Yeah,
separately?
Yeah. If you could break out CDS separately, that would be terrific.
Mm-hmm. And is the reason that CDS wouldn't be sort of 100% of the notional would be the exposure or the value at risk?
Yeah.
Is that because a lot of them are pay-as-you-go credit default swaps? As I understand it, at least take, for example, the way AIG's credit default swaps worked. You paid a premium, so to speak, in order to get protection on the full amount of an exposure. And so if any of that part of that exposure loses value, if the bond gets eaten into the principal, then AIG may take the bond back, but it owes 100 cents on the dollar for the notional value of that exposure. So I don't understand how the credit default swap could be, how the exposure percentage that you're talking about could be so low.
It is. The pay-as-you-go concept relates solely to credit default swaps written on either asset-backed securities or CDOs. And that is to reflect the fact that if you've got a pool of assets in an ABS or a CDO, those assets aren't all going to default at once, or at least that was the theory, right? So that as a bond in the ABS portfolio went bankrupt, you'd pay up for that piece of, but that they'd written protection on the whole ABS.
And so under the pay-as-you-go scenario, it makes sense that the net exposure would be less than the full notional amount of the CDS.
Well, and then in terms of, let's take a plain vanilla single name credit default swap on Ford Motor Company, all right? If I've bought protection from you on that at some point in time, I would have committed to pay you a premium. That premium at the time the deal is done is more or less the market's assessment of the probability that Ford will default and the expected recovery rate on Ford bonds in the event that there was a default. Now, you've written $100 million notional, but the premium I'm paying is going to be some fraction of that to reflect that probability of default and recovery rate. If Ford's situation should worsen, the premium in the market will be higher. I'll have a good deal. I'll be in the money as a result of that. But there won't actually be a payout on that until there is actually a default. And so the market price will reflect the move, the market's assessment of the creditworthiness and the likelihood of a default by Ford over time, or at a particular point in time.
So does the exposure number you're talking about take into account that probability?
That's exactly in this article in the FT.
I see.
We said assume a certain, but that, if you want to get a sense as to the potential defaults, the cost of defaults at this point in time, that's the proper analysis. Yes, you're right. If let's just take single names as a result, if every company on which there was credit protection written defaulted today and there was a zero recovery rate on their bonds, then yes, that number, which is the sum total of all those $100 million, would be the right analysis. But you tell me, likely? How likely is that?
I'm not sure that's true, because maybe the compression has changed this, but I thought if you take a Ford Motor credit, and maybe it's $100 million, and someone has that exposure, that person buys a credit default swap. That's $100 million in notional amount. Then the person who has the obligation on the credit default swap, that is the protecting obligation, goes out and hedges. That's another $100 million that is counted as, is it not, in the market as a notional amount.
Yeah,
so
you really, what you'd really look at is that on the DCC seed page, the net protection written on an A. There is, and then the only modification to that is my assumption of all the names defaulting on the same day assumes that all the sellers pay up, meaning they make good on their credit, their obligation to pay. Obviously, there's always, as there isn't any derivative, there's credit, counterparty credit exposure.
Right.
But you're right, you'd look at the net, essentially the open position as reflected on the DTC.
But there's one more point, I think, and that is it's a $100 million bond, and there could be 30 or 40 participants in credit default swaps relating to, in some way, to that $100 million bond.
Right.
If that fails, they all pay one another, but the loss, the total loss, is only $100 million. There could have been $2 billion in notional amount out on that single 100 million-dollar bond.
That's right, yeah.
But the actual amount of the loss is $100 million if that bond fails, and it's a total loss rather than just a partial loss.
Right, supposed to recover it, yeah.
So that's why I always thought that the idea of notional amount is misleading, because it doesn't reflect all of these hedges that everyone is putting on a single potential loss.
Well, that's an element of it, yes. It's also, and that's particularly apt in the credit default swap area.
Yeah, I was thinking only of credit
default swaps. Yeah, but if we're looking at that 0.6% that I was mentioning across the different product types, and there is more a function of where is the, you know, since under on an interest rate swap, you'll never pay that notional amount. It's only there to calculate the cash flows on the trade, whereas that's one unique thing. There are a few unique things about credit default swaps, but that's one thing. Somebody may actually have to pay that $100 million on that trade, so that the calculation of the net exposure, the real amount at risk for interest rate swaps is different from credit default swaps, but fundamentally that percentage is not vastly different from interest rates versus credit.
We exhausted.
I think we're out of time.
Yeah,
that's it.
Okay.
Well, and I think Paul was making some notes of things to follow up on in terms of documents or references and things like that.
We can
pull that together. And
January 08 was the FT article.
January 08, yeah.
And I'd love to see that article.
I can.
Thank you.
If you have other questions, you know, feel free to contact. Probably best to go through Peter.
So,
or.